outside their houses. Workmen, hammers in hand, shout hello from ladders and half-shingled roofs. I'm willing to bet that the local operating rooms are windowless and have doors that are solid wood. Otherwise, the surgeons and nurses would feel obliged to acknowledge everyone who passed down the hall, and patients could possibly die as a result. While the Sound side of the island feels like an old-fashioned neighborhood, the Ocean side is more like an upscale retirement community. Look out a street-facing window on any given morning, and you'd think they were filming a Centrum commercial, all these hale, silver-haired seniors walking or jogging or cycling past the house. Later in the day, when the heat cranks up, they purr by in golf carts, wearing visors, their noses streaked with sunblock. If you were a teenager, you likely wouldn't give it much thought. But to my sisters and me, people in our mid to late 50s, it's chilling. That'll be us in like 8 years, we think. How can that be when only yesterday, on this very same beach, we were children? Of course, the alternative is worse. When my mother was the age that I am now, she couldn't walk more than 10 steps without stopping to catch her breath. And stairs, forget it. In that regard, our father is her opposite. At 91, the only things wrong with him are his toes. My doctor wants to cut one off, but I think he's overreacting, he said on the second morning of our vacation. The sun shone brightly through the floor-to-ceiling windows, and he was sitting shirtless at the kitchen table on the side of the house that Hugh and I share, wearing black spandex shorts. The toes he presented from my inspection looked like fingers playing the piano, all of them long and bent and splayed. How do you fit those things into shoes, I asked, wincing. Wouldn't it be easier to go the Howard Hughes route and just wear tissue boxes on your feet? Just then the plumber arrived to look at our broken dishwasher. Randy is huge in every way, and as we shook hands, I thought of how small mine must have felt within his, like a paw, almost. "So it seems to be a problem," he asked. "It's the same story every time. Hugh calls and schedules an appointment regarding something I know nothing about. Then he leaves for God knows where, and I'm left to explain what I don't understand." "I guess it's not washing the dishes right or something," I said. Randy pulled a screwdriver from his tool belt and bent down toward a panel. "Ought to come sooner, but we're still catching up from the winter we had. Pipes froze, all kinds of mess." "Was it that cold?" I asked. "Never seen anything like it," he said. My father raised his coffee cup. "And they talk about global warming. Ha!" After 20 minutes or so, Randy suggested we get a new dishwasher, a KitchenAid, if possible. "They're not that expensive, and they'll probably be cheaper than fixing this here one." I showed him to the door. And as he made his way down the stairs, my father asked when I was going to have my prostate checked. "You need to get that taken care of ASAP. While you're at it, you might want to get a complete physical. I mean the works." "What does that have to do with the dishwasher?" I wondered. When Hugh returned, I passed on Randy's suggestion regarding the KitchenAid, and he nodded. "While he was here, did you ask him about the leak under the sink?" "I didn't know I was supposed to." "God damn it, I told you last night." My father tapped me on the shoulder. "You need to call a doctor and get a checkup." This was my second trip to our house on Emerald Isle, and the second time my entire family, or what was left of it, was assembling here. Summer was still a month away, and already the temperature was in the 90s. The humidity was high. And once you left the beach, the breeze disappeared, inviting in its dearth great squadrons of biting flies. Still, I would force myself out every afternoon. On one of my walks, I came across my brother and his daughter Madeline, standing on a footbridge a few blocks inland from our house and dropping bread into the brackish canal. I thought they were feeding fish, but it turned out they were throwing the food to turtles, dozens of them. Most had shells between 6 and 8 inches long, and are what my sister Gretchen, who owns a lot of reptiles, calls sliders. Then there were the snapping turtles. The largest measured around 3.5 feet from nose to tail. Part of his left front foot was missing, and he had a tumor on his head the size of my niece's fist. "And you're giving them bread?" I said to Paul. It made me think of my first visit to Spokane, Washington. I was walking through the park that fronts the river there and happened upon people feeding animals that resembled groundhogs. "What are these?" I asked a man who was kneeling with his arm outstretched. "Marmots," he told me. "And what do they eat?" He reached into a bag he kept at his feet. "Marshmallows." I've subsequently seen people feed all sorts of things to the turtles in the canal on Emerald Isle, dried dog food, Cheerios, Pop-Tarts, potato chips. "None of that is good for them," Gretchen says. Her turtles eat mainly worms and slugs. They like fruit as well, and certain vegetables, but potato chips, no. "What about barbecued potato chips?" I asked. During the week that we spent at the beach, I'd visit the canal every afternoon, sometimes with raw hot dogs, sometimes with fish heads or chicken gizzards. The sliders would poke their heads out of the water, begging, but it was the snappers I was there for. Seeing one was like seeing a dinosaur, for isn't that what they are? Watching as they tore into their food, I'd shiver with fear and revulsion, the way I used to when watching my brother eat. On YouTube, there's a video of one biting off a finger, and of the man whose finger it used to be acting terribly surprised, the way that people who offer sandwiches to bears or jump security fences to pose beside tigers ultimately are. There are other videos of snapping turtles eating rats and pigeons and frogs, all of which are still alive, their pathetic attempts at self-defense futile. It's a kind of pornography. And after sitting for 20 minutes, watching one poor animal after another being eviscerated, I erase my internet user history, not wanting to be identified as the person who would find this sort of thing entertaining, yet clearly being that person. Did it help, I wondered, that my favorite turtle was the one with the oversized tumor on his head and half his front foot missing? Did that make me a friend of the sick and the suffering? Or just the kind of guy who wants both ice cream and whipped cream on his pie? Aren't snapping turtles terrible enough? Did I really need to supersize one with a cancerous growth? My main reason for buying the house on Emerald Isle was that it would allow my family to spend more time together, especially now while my father's still around. Instead, though, I was spending all my time with these turtles. Not that we didn't do anything as a group. One afternoon, we scattered my mother's ashes in the surf behind the house. Afterward, standing on the shore with the empty bag in my hands, I noticed a trawler creeping across the horizon. It was after shrimp or some kind of fish, and hovering over it like flies around a garbage pail were dozens of screaming seabirds. It made me think of my mother and how we'd follow her even to the bathroom. "Can't I have 5 minutes?" she'd plead from behind the locked door as we jiggled the handle, relating something terribly important about tights or a substitute teacher or a dream one of us had had about a talking glove. My mother died in 1991, yet reaching into the bag, touching her remains, essentially throwing her away, was devastating, even after all this time. Later, drained, we piled into the car and drove to the small city of Beaufort. There we went to a coffee shop and fell in line behind a young man with a gun. It was tucked into a holster he wore belted around his waist, and after he had got his order and taken a seat with two people I took to be his parents, we glared at him with what might as well have been a single eye. Even my father, who laughs appreciatively at such bumper stickers as, "Don't blame me, I voted for the American," draws the line at carrying a pistol into a place where lattes are being served. "What's he trying to prove?" he asked. The guy was my height, or maybe a little shorter, wearing pressed jeans. "He's obviously got a complex of some kind," my sister-in-law Kathy said. "It's called being a Republican," Lisa offered. My father frowned into his decaf. "Oh, come on now." I mentioned a couple of T-shirts I'd seen people wearing on the pier not far from my turtle spot. "Invest in heavy metals," read one, and it pictured three bullets labeled brass, copper, and lead. Another showed a pistol above the message, "When you come for mine, you better bring yours." "Since when is the government coming for anyone's guns in this country?" I asked. "I mean, honestly, can't any of us enter a Walmart right now and walk out with the Sidewinder missile?" It was a nice moment, all of us on the same page. Then my father ruined it by asking when I'd last had a physical. "Just recently," I said. "Recently, like when?" 1987, I told him, adding after he moaned, "You do know this is the fourth time today you've asked me about this, right? I mean, you're not just being 91, are you?" "No," he said, "I know what I'm saying." "Well, can you please stop saying it? I will when you get a physical." "Is this really how you want to be remembered?" I asked. "As a nagger with hammer toes?" "I'm just showing my concern," he said. "Can't you see that I'm doing this for your own good? Jesus, son, I want you to have a long, healthy life. I love you. Is that a crime?" The C-section came completely furnished, and the first thing we did after getting the keys was to load up all the televisions and donate them to a thrift shop. It's nice at night to work puzzles or play board games or just hang out, maybe listening to music. The only one this is difficult for is my father. Back in Raleigh, he has two or three TVs going at the same time, all tuned to the same conservative cable station, filling his falling down house with outrage. The one reprieve is his daily visit to the gym, where he takes part in a spinning class. Amy and I like to joke that his stationary bike has a front wheel as tall as a man and a rear one no bigger than a pie tin, that it's a penny farthing, the kind people rode in the 1880s. On its handlebars, we imagine a trumpet horn with a big rubber bulb on one end. Being at the beach is a drag for our father. To his credit, though, he never complains about it, just as he never mentions the dozens of aches and pains a person his age must surely be burdened by. "I'm fine just hanging out," he says. "Being together, that's all I need." He no longer swims or golfs or fishes off the pier. We banned his right-wing radio show, so all that's left is to shuffle from one side of the house to the other, sometimes barefoot and sometimes wearing leather slippers the color of a new baseball mitt. "Those are beautiful," I said the first time I noticed them. "Where do they come from?" He looked down at his feet and cleared his throat. "Catalog?" "They arrived back in the early 80s, but I only just recently started wearing them." "If anything should ever happen to you, do you think that maybe I could have them?" I asked. "What would ever happen to me?" In the ocean that afternoon, I watched my brother play with his daughter. The waves were high, and as Madeline hung laughing off Paul's shoulders, I thought of how we used to do the same with our own father. It's the only time any of us ever touched him. Perhaps for that reason, I can still recall the feel of his skin, slick with suntan oil, and much softer than I had imagined it. Our mother couldn't keep our hands off her. If we'd had ink on our fingers, at the end of an average day, she'd have been black, the way we mauled and poked and petted her. With him, though, we never dared get too close. Even in the ocean, there'd come a moment when, without warning, he'd suddenly reach his limit and shake us off, growling, "God almighty, will you just leave me alone?" He was so much heavier back then, always determined to lose 30 pounds. Half a century later, he'd do well to gain 30 pounds. Paul embraced him after our sister Tiffany died and reported that it was like hugging a coat rack. "What I do," he says every night while Hugh puts dinner together, "is take a chicken breast, broil it with a little EVOO, and serve it with some lentils. Fantastic." Though my father talks big, we suspect the bulk of his meals come from whatever they're offering as free samples at his neighborhood Whole Foods, the one we give him gift cards for. How else to explain how he puts it away while we're all together, eating as if in preparation for a fast? "Outstanding," he says between bites, the muscles of his jaws twitching beneath his spotted skin. "My compliments to the chef." One night I looked over and saw that he was wearing a Cherokee headdress someone had brought to the house for Thanksgiving. Paul had put it on him, and rather than shake it off the way he would have a few years earlier, he accepted it, owned it, really. Just before dessert was served, Amy and I noticed that he was crying. He looked like the Indian from that old Keep America Beautiful ad campaign, one single tear running down his cheek. He never blubbered or called attention to himself, so we never asked what the problem was, or if there even was a problem. "Maybe he was happy that we were all together," Lisa said when we told her about it. Gretchen guessed that he was thinking about our mother, or Tiffany, while Paul wondered if it wasn't an allergic reaction to feathers. It's not that our father waited till this late in the game to win our hearts. It's that he's succeeding. "But he didn't used to be this nice and agreeable," I complained to Hugh. "Well, he is now," he said. "Why can't you let people change?" This is akin to another of his often asked questions. "Why do you choose to remember the negative rather than the positive?" "I don't," I insist, thinking I will never forget your giving me such a hard time over this. Honestly, though, does choice even come into it? Is it my fault that the good times fade to nothing while the bad ones burn forever bright? Memory aside, the negative just makes for a better story. The plane was delayed. An infection set in. Outlaws arrived and reduced the schoolhouse to ashes. Happiness is harder to put into words. It's also harder to source, much more mysterious than anger or sorrow, which come to me promptly whenever I summon them, and remain long after I've begged them to leave. For whatever reason, I was very happy with my snapping turtles. In the wild, they can live up to 30 years, though I fear that my favorite, the one with the hideous growth on his head, might not make it that long. There's something wrong with his breathing, though he still manages to mount the females every chance he gets. "Oh, look," a passerby said, pointing down into the churning water on the last full day of our vacation. "They're playing." I looked at the man with an incredulity that bordered on anger. "Snapping turtles don't play," I said, "not even when they're babies. They're reptiles, for Christ's sake." "Can you believe it?" I said to my father when I got back to the beach house that evening. He was standing beside the sofa, wearing a shirt I clearly remember throwing into his trash can in the summer of 1990 and enjoying a glass of vodka with a little water in it. All around him, people were helping with dinner. Lisa and Amy were setting the table while Gretchen prepared the salad and Paul loaded his juicer with what looked like dirt. Hugh brought fish up from the grill, and as Kathy and Madeline rounded up chairs, I put on some music. "Attaboy," my father said. "That's just what we needed. Is this Hank Mobley?" "It is," I told him. "I thought so. I used to have this on reel-to-reel tape." While I know I can't control it, what I ultimately hope to recall about my late-in-life father is not his nagging or his toes, but rather his fingers and the way he snaps them when listening to jazz. He's done it forever, signifying, much as a cat does by purring, that you may approach, that all is right with the world. "Man, oh man," he'll say in my memory, lifting his glass and taking us all in. "Isn't this just fantastic?"
Your English is so good. There's a language instruction course I turn to quite often, PIMSLR it's called, and I first used it in 2006 when preparing for a trip to Japan. "I am American," I was taught to announce somewhat sheepishly at the start of lesson one. Half an hour later, I'd advanced to "Nihongo ga jozu desu ne," which translates to, "Your Japanese is so good." It seemed a bit early in the game to be receiving compliments, but still I learned to recognize the phrase and to respond to it, saying, "Thank you very much, but I am not really skilled yet." This came in handy, as once I got to Tokyo, every time I opened my mouth, I was clobbered with praise, even if I was just saying something simple, like, "huh." The same was true with a number of other phrases I'd considered unnecessary, but heard again and again once I arrived in Japan. The fact is that unless we're with friends or family, we're all like talking dolls, endlessly repeating the same trite and tiresome lines. "Hello, how are you? Hot enough out there? Don't work too hard." I'm often misunderstood at my supermarket in Sussex, not because of my accent, but because I tend to deviate from the script. Cashier: "Hello, how are you this evening?" Me: "Has your house ever been burgled?" Cashier: "What?" Me: "Your house, has anyone ever broken into it and stolen things?" With me, people aren't thinking, "What did you say?" so much as, "Why are you saying that?" I know that Pimsleur offers an English course for native Spanish speakers, but I'm not sure if it's geared toward UK English or what you hear in the United States. The former would most certainly include "at the end of the day." Turn on British TV or follow anyone named Ian for more than a few minutes, and you're guaranteed to hear it. In France, the most often used word is "connery," which means bullshit. And in America, it's hands down "awesome," which has replaced "incredible," "good," and even "just okay." Pretty much everything that isn't terrible is awesome in America now. Pimsleur has made me hyper-aware of the phrases I hear most often over the course of an average day, so aware that I've started jotting them down in hopes of putting together my own English program, one for business travelers visiting the United States. Let's start at the airport newsstand, shall we? There you'll lay a magazine upon the counter and be asked by the cashier, "Do you need some water to go with that?" This will be said as if the two things should not really be sold separately. As if in order to properly read a copy of Us Weekly, you'll have to first rinse your eyes out with a $4 bottle of Avion. The practice of pushing more stuff on you is called upselling, and it's one of those things that once you notice it, you can't stop noticing it. At the airport in Baton Rouge a few years back, I ordered a coffee. "Do you need a pastry to go with that?" the young man behind the counter asked. "I wasn't too shy to order the coffee," I said. "So what makes you think I'd hold back on a bear claw if I wanted one?" The fellow shrugged. "We have Danish, too." This made me furious. On second thought, "I don't want anything," I told him. Then I went a few doors down to Dunkin' Donuts and said, "I would like nothing but coffee, just coffee, period." The woman behind the counter crossed her arms. "No cup." "Well, of course I want a cup. No milk or nothing." This always happens when I try to make a point. "And milk," I told her. "Coffee in a cup with some milk in it, but nothing else." Then, of course, my flight got delayed by 2 hours, and I had to go crawling back for some munchkins. "Do you need coffee or soda to go with that?" the woman had replaced the one I'd spoken to earlier asked. Increasingly at southern airports, instead of a goodbye or thank you, cashiers are apt to say, "Have a blessed day." This can make you feel like you've been sprayed against your will with God cologne. "Get it off me," I always want to scream, quick, before I start wearing ties with short-sleeved shirts. As a business traveler, you'll likely be met at your destination by someone who asks, so how was your flight? This as if there are interesting variations, and you might answer, the live orchestra was a nice touch. Or the first half was great, but then they let a baby take over the controls, and it got all bumpy. In fact, there are only two kinds of flights, ones in which you die, and ones in which you do not. Next, you'll meet the desk clerk at your hotel, a woman most likely, in her mid to late 30s. She won't know if you've driven to this city or flown, and will ask after taking your credit card, so how was your trip in? There's really no answer, but fine. I mean, there is, but I'm guessing she won't want to hear it. Or would she? Her, so how was your trip in? You, well, I was originally going to fly, but then this tiger offered to carry me very gently in her mouth. I said, okay, but you know what? She wasn't gentle at all. One of her teeth pierced my small intestine. So now, on top of everything else, I have to shit in a bag every day for the rest of my life. Her, well, that is just awesome. We're all so glad you made it. After the desk clerk hands you your key, the bellman will grab your suitcase and ask, so where are you coming in from today? Like everyone else at the hotel, he doesn't really listen to your answer. His words are just a hook to hang a tip on. You could say you're from a town 10 miles down the road or from another dimension. Either way, you get the same response. You're a long way from home, aren't you? I object to these questions not because they're personal, but because they're not. Instead of asking how my trip in was, why not ask, I don't know, if I have a godson? I said to a desk clerk not long ago. She took off her glasses and rubbed the bridge of her nose. All right, do you have a godson? I do, I said. He's 8 years old and is named Tommy. How about you? Do you have any godchildren? No, the woman told me. I have not had that pleasure. She smiled like someone who'd learned to do so in a book. And I realized that if I wanted to make contact, I needed to dig a little deeper. He has cancer, I said. The desk clerk put her hand over her heart. Oh, poor thing. That's okay, I sighed. I'm sure that within a year or two, someone else will ask me to be a godfather. It wasn't true that Tommy had cancer. I just wanted to get a rise out of her, to feel some kind of pulse. I knew that the young woman had a life. She'd gone to school somewhere. She had friends. I didn't need a 15-minute conversation, just some human interaction. It can be had, and easily, a gesture, a joke, something that says, I live in this world too. I think of it as a switch that turns someone from a profession to a person, and it works both ways. I'm not just a vehicle for my wallet, I sometimes want to scream. Go to a restaurant anywhere in the United States, and 3 minutes after your food is delivered, your server will return to the table asking, how's that southeastern lard pocket? Once in Kansas City, this was amended to, how's that southeastern lard pocket tasting for you? As if the lard pocket had the tongue instead of me. Mmm, I said, my mouth full, the way it always is when the server returns. Awesome, I was told. I hope you're saving some room for dessert. This with a chuckle that means, wouldn't it be funny if what I just said was funny? The following morning, you'll wander to the hotel breakfast room, and tell the hostess there's only one in your party. She'll pick up a menu and lead you to your table asking, and how's your day going so far? You mean the last 12 minutes, you'll ask? Okay, I guess. And she'll say, awesome. If you've come directly downstairs, this might be the first time since last night that you've heard this word. That doesn't make it refreshing. Rather, it's like being in Alaska and getting bitten by your first black fly of the day. I'm going to be bleeding by sunset, you'll think. More often than not, your breakfast room will have a TV in it, tuned to a 24-hour cable news network. Sometimes you'll see two TVs or more. At a place I stayed at in Kentucky one year, there were eight. After I ordered, the waitress went around with her remote and activated each one, making me think of a lamplighter, if lamps were instruments of torture rather than things that make it easier for you to see how old and tired-looking you've gotten. People like it, she said, when I asked if it was really necessary at 6 o'clock in the morning. You hear this a lot in America, especially when you're complaining about televisions or loud music, or more common still, televisions and loud music together in the same room. People like it. Yes, I always want to say, but they're the wrong people. On leaving your hotel, you'll likely be offered a bottle of water, and urgently, by the fellow who just brought your car around. You'll need this for your trip to the airport. I'm actually not walking there, I always say. This car is taking me, and I should arrive in no time. Everyone in America is extremely concerned with hydration. Go more than 5 minutes without drinking, and you'll surely be discovered behind a potted plant, dried out like some escaped hermit crab. When I was young, no one would think to bring a bottle of water into a classroom. They didn't even sell bottled water. We survived shopping trips without it, and funerals. Now, though, you see people with those barrels that St. Bernards carry around their necks in cartoons, lugging them into the mall and the movie theater, then hogging the fountains in order to refill them. Is that really necessary, I think, as I stand behind them with an aspirin dissolving in my mouth, fuming? Should you wander into a shop during your visit to the United States, you can expect a clerk to say, "So what are we up to today?" We, as if the two of you had made plans you forgot about. Oh, I usually say, already sorry I walked in. I'm just looking around. Awesome. If you purchase something, you'll be asked at the register what you're going to do with the rest of your afternoon. Oh, I don't know. Buy more shit? My friend Ronnie manages a shoe store, so is fluent in this kind of talk. When we're out together, she takes over, and effortlessly, while I look on, amazed. Doing about as well as can be expected, she says, when asked about her health by someone who could not possibly give a fuck. Because she lives in California, Ronnie is on the front lines. "Did you catch that?" she whispered one afternoon in San Francisco. "That salesman just said, 'Welcome in.'" "So?" I asked. "That's the latest thing," she told me. "I'm hearing it everywhere now." "Should we add it to the list?" "Definitely." The list is a growing collection of words and phrases we'd outlaw if given the power to do so. It includes "awesome," of course, and "it is what it is," which is ubiquitous now and means absolutely nothing as far as we can see. "Isn't that the state motto of South Dakota?" I said the second or third time I heard it. Some of my additions to the list were things that Ronnie wasn't familiar with. "We're all going to the same place," for instance. This is what novice flyers in Group 5 say when they get caught trying to board with Group 2. Sure, we're all headed to St. Louis. The difference is that some people, me, are going to find room in the overhead bins, and others, you, are not. These same passengers can be counted on to catch my eye and moan, "Hurry up and wait," when traffic backs up on the jetway. I cock my head and look at them with an expression that translates to, "Why is stuff coming from that hole in your face?" Another word I've added to the list is conversation, as in, we need to have a national conversation about blank. This is employed by the left to mean, you need to listen to me use the word diversity for an hour. The right employs obnoxious terms as well, libtard, snowflake, etc. But because they can be applied to me personally, it seems babyish to ban them. I've outlawed meds, bestie, bucket list, dysfunctional, expat, cab salve, and the verb do when used in a restaurant, as in, I'll do the snails on cinnamon toast. Ugh, Ronnie agrees, do, that's the worst. My new thing, I told her, is to look at the menu and say, I'd like to purchase the veal chop. A lot of our outlawed terms were invented by black people and then picked up by whites who held on to them way past their expiration date. My bad, for example, and I've got your back, and you go, girlfriend. They're the verbal equivalents of sitcom grandmothers high-fiving one another. And on hearing them, I wince and feel ashamed of my entire race. The weak link of my American English for Business Travelers program is the business part. It used to be that I could eavesdrop on a conversation and learn that the two men at the next table were doctors, or that one was a massage therapist and the other sold life insurance for cats. Now, though, I have no idea what anyone does, especially if the people I'm listening in on are under 40. I hear the words integration and platform a lot, but not in any recognizable context. Theirs are the offices, I imagine, where Kaysen rides his scooter down the concrete hallway, passing a warren of workspaces that resemble cages. And no one's shirt is tucked in. That's one phrase that won't be in my English book. Nice suit. 20 years from now, they probably won't even be making them anymore. Dressing up will mean wearing the sweatpants without paint on them to your father's funeral. My American English for Business Travelers will teach you to recognize the most often repeated words and phrases, but hopefully leave room for wonder. I'm constantly surprised and delighted by some of the things I hear while traveling across the United States. I'm thinking of a fellow bus passenger who turned to me as our driver barely missed a pedestrian, saying, "See? He don't love life." Of a Memphis panhandler who called as I passed, "Hey, man, why don't you buy me a Coca-Cola?" Of the newsstand cashier who did not suggest I buy a bottle of water, but rather looked at the price of my Sunday Times and said, "That's $5, baby. You okay with that?" Or of the pilot who somberly said as he turned off the seatbelt at the end of a flight, "All rise." Now that's what I'm talking about.
Calypso. The deal with America is that it's always something. I go twice a year and arrive each time on the heels of a major news story. SARS, anthrax, H1N1, bed bugs. In the fall of 2014, the story was Ebola. Not the thousands who had died of it in Africa, but the single person who had it in Dallas. Because there are TVs everywhere one goes, restaurants, hotel lobbies, airports, even, I discovered, doctors' waiting rooms, And because they're all tuned to one cable news network or other, the coverage was inescapable. Every angle was explored, then subsequently beaten to death. When the patient, whose name was Thomas Duncan, died, you'd think he'd taken half the country down with him. A teacher in Maine was sent home because she'd flown to Dallas, not to the hospital where the man had been cared for, but just to the city. Schools closed. Hysterical parents were interviewed. "Ebola is here," we were told by the media, "and it's coming to get you." I started seeing people wearing face masks in the airport and decided that I hated them. What bugged me, I realized, was their flagrant regard for their own lives. It seemed not just overcautious, but downright conceited. I mean, why should they live? "Stay safe," a Starbucks employee said to me one morning. I was in a hurry to get to my gate, so didn't stop to ask, "Safe from what?" I was in the United States for a lecture tour, 45 cities in 47 days. "My God," people say when they look at my schedule, "but it isn't like real work. The travel can occasionally be taxing, but anyone can turn pages and read out loud." What takes time are the post-show book signings. My fault, because I talk too much. "What kind of a name is Draven?" I asked one evening, squinting at the post-it note attached to the title page. "I don't know exactly," the woman on the other side of the table said. "He's a friend of my brother." I looked at the name again. Draven. It sounds like the past tense of drove. In most of the cities on my tour, I didn't know anyone, but here and there I caught up with people. In Winston-Salem, it was my sister Lisa. A week later in Omaha, I saw my old friend Janet and her 25-year-old son Jimmy, who was tall and thin and was sporting a long, rust-colored beard. Back when we met in the late 1980s, Janet was highlighting the grain in rectangular sheets of plywood. That was her artwork. Now she just leaves the rectangles as they are and has founded something called the Wood Interpretation Society. "Jimmy," she said, standing in the living room that doubles as her studio, "fetch me my stick." Her son handed her a length of bamboo, and she used it to point to her most recent piece. "All right, can you see the snowman?" I saw nothing, so she gestured to two knots. "His eyes? You can't see his eyes?" "Well, okay," I said. "Sure, a little." "And now can you see that he's talking to an owl?" "Owls are a dime a dozen in wood grain," Jimmy explained. "That's true," his mother said, and she moved on to her next piece of plywood, in which a turtle considered a mountain. "And this is all just found," she told me. "I honestly haven't altered a thing." Later, over coffee, we got onto the subject of elderly parents. Janet's mother is 89 and is in excellent physical and mental health, unlike my friend Phil's mother, she said. This was a woman who never missed a church service, who was an absolute pillar of her community. Then she got dementia and became a different person. She poured me more coffee. The last time Phil saw her, she leaned over in her wheelchair and at the top of her voice said, "Hitler wants my pussy." Jimmy stroked his bib-like beard. They say he was quite the ladies' man. "Who even knew that word was in her vocabulary?" Janet asked. "And how had Hitler told her? He'd been dead for 50 years by that point." Being with Janet reminded me of how lucky I am. At 92, my father is in great shape, and should that suddenly change for any reason, he probably won't linger all that long. I'd like to think I inherited his constitution, but in fact, I'm more like my mother. Thus I took it seriously when, at the post-show book signing that night in Omaha, a fellow with a noticeable divot in his face pointed to a dark spot beside my left eye, saying, "I'm no doctor, but I'm 90% sure you have skin cancer." 4 days later, I saw a dermatologist in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. The spot, he said, was nothing to worry about. Then he used the word cancer, albeit with a pre in front of it. "A little precancerous keratosis." He hit it with some liquid nitrogen, and by the time I left his office, it looked like I had a pencil eraser stuck to my face. The following day on the plane, the eraser burst, and precancer juice ran like a fat tear down my cheek. That was the first of several procedures I wound up having over the course of my tour. Funny, but for years I avoided going to any kind of doctor. If it was an emergency, I could be talked into it, but anything else, especially anything preventative, was out of the question. Then my father forced me to get a colonoscopy, and a whole new world opened up. The paperwork is a drag, of course. So many forms that by the time you're in the examining room, you have to add carpal tunnel to your already long list of complaints. As far as the doctors themselves go, though, I've had a pretty good run. In the summer of 2014, while on vacation at my family's beach house on the coast of North Carolina, and again at the insistence of my father, I went in for a physical. "All right, then," the GP said, after taking my blood pressure and looking into my ears. "What do you say? You stand up now and I'll do your front and back." It was such a classy, understated way to say, "After grabbing your balls, I'd like to stick my finger up your ass." The dermatologist was fun to talk to, as was a nurse who gave me a flu shot while I was passing through O'Hare. The only exception I've had so far is a surgeon I saw on the coast of North Carolina a few days after having my physical. 6 years earlier, I had noticed a lump on my right side, just at the base of my rib cage. It was, I later learned, a lipoma, meaning a harmless fatty tumor. It continued to grow for the next several months until it was the size and feel of an unshelled, hard-boiled egg. I could have lived with it for the rest of my life, but after spending some time along the canals not far from our beach house, I got a better idea. The surgeon I met with didn't have much in the way of personality. That's not to say that he was rude, just perfunctory. He took an ultrasound of my fatty tumor and said that he could remove it the following week. "Terrific," I said, "because I want to feed it to a snapping turtle." "Excuse me?" "Not just any snapping turtle," I continued, as if that was what had given him pause. "There's one very specific turtle I'm planning to feed it to. He has a big growth on his head. It's against federal law for me to give you anything I've removed from your body," the surgeon said. "But it's my tumor," I reminded him. "I made it." "It's against federal law for me to give you anything I've removed from your body. Well, could I maybe have half to feed to this turtle?" "It's against federal law for me to give you anything I've removed from your body." I left with my tumor intact, thinking, honestly, what has this country come to? On tour sometimes, just before the question and answer part of the evening, I'll stand at the podium and run my mouth for a while. I told the story about the tumor on stage in El Paso, Texas, and afterward, a woman approached my signing table saying, "I'll cut that out of you tonight if you like, and I'll let you keep it." I pointed out the long line and she shrugged. "No problem. I'm a night owl." She handed me a slip of paper with her number on it. "Just phone me when you're done." The woman looked to be around 50, Mexican, I reckoned, and as short as a child. "In case you're wondering, I am a doctor," she said. "Not a surgeon, but I studied it for a year in med school, and unless your tumor has its own blood supply, removing it should be fairly easy." Its own blood supply. I thought of those people you read about sometimes with terrible potato-sized twins inside of them, complete with hair and teeth. Recounting this story over the next few weeks, I was surprised by the general reaction it got. "She what? You didn't take her up on it, did you?" "Well, sure. And how do you know she was a real doctor?" These were the same overly cautious people who threw out their children's Halloween candy and showed up at airports with masks on. "How do I know she was a doctor? She told me she was." The only real exception was my father, who once took antibiotics prescribed for his dog, saying, "Ah, who cares? They're the same damn thing." When I told him that a strange woman performed surgery on me in the middle of the night, his response was the same as mine would have been. Sounds like you saved yourself some real money. The doctor, I'll call her Ada, returned to the theater after I'd finished signing books at around 1 a.m. With her were the son and daughter of her girlfriend, both of whom were in their early 30s and looked more like soap opera actors than real people. While their attractiveness was preternatural, almost outlandish, the way they related to each other as brother and sister felt familiar to me, especially their little insults, blanks for the most part, more funny than mean. The four of us drove on deserted roads across the state line to a dark clinic located in what seemed like the middle of nowhere. The late hour, the secrecy. It felt furtive and dangerous, like having an abortion in 1950. My procedure began with the local anesthetic, and though I didn't notice when Ada cut into me, I could feel slight tugs as she hacked at the tumor. It was like having my pocket picked by a trainee, my fatty pocket. The shreds were placed in a metal pan and resembled slivers of raw chicken breast. "Are my intestines hanging out?" I asked at one point. "God, no," Ada said. "Your lipoma is in a sort of pouch, so there's nothing at all protruding from the incision. If you want, you can look for yourself. I can get you a mirror." "That's okay," I said. While she worked, I talked to the son and daughter of her girlfriend, hyper-conscious of how good they looked and, by contrast, how awful I did, half sitting up, my hairy stomach showing. "How do you say tumor in Espanol?" I asked. "Tumor," the woman said. I took Spanish in high school, and I'm always delighted when I find another word I can toss into my vocabulary basket. It was like learning that shortcake is pronounced shotokeki in Japanese and beige, beige in German. After I was stitched back up, we drove to Ada's house, the only one with lights burning on its quiet suburban street. There I met her girlfriend Anna, who wore a floor-length white nightgown. Her hair was white as well, and fell to the middle of her back. "So nice of you to drop by," she said, opening a bottle of codeine tablets. "Will you take some for the road? For the pain?" The house felt familiar. If not exactly like the one I grew up in, then at least close. Artsy, my mom would have called it, meaning there were paintings on the walls, but they weren't all pretty. The backyard was flooded with moonlight, and while looking out at the sleeping city below us, Anna's daughter told me about her youngest child, a girl of 5. "She's going through a phase where she wants to be a dog, insists she's a dog. The barking and walking around on all fours is something I'm willing to put up with, but then she shit on the ground over by that shrub, and I said, 'That's it, now you've gone too far.'" At 4 a.m., Ada and her girlfriend's children returned me to my hotel, and 3 hours later, I got up to go to the airport. All told, it was an exceptional evening, a chance to meet interesting new people and have at least one of them reach inside of me with her tiny hands. After I left El Paso, Ada shipped my tumor on ice to my sister's house in Winston-Salem. Lisa put it in the freezer and promised to bring it with her to the beach when we gathered for Thanksgiving at the end of my tour. Meanwhile, I continued on. In Houston, I had an emergency root canal, which didn't hurt nearly as much as I thought it would. A few days later, perhaps because hanging out with doctors was something I'd gotten into the habit of, I saw a podiatrist in Dallas. "What seems to be the problem?" he asked. "My left foot hurts," I told him. He took some x-rays, but nothing showed up, perhaps because my foot only hurt a little. "This has to stop," said my lecture agent, who'd been making all the appointments for me and was clearly tired of it. My last show was in Tallahassee, Florida, and the following morning I flew to Raleigh. My sister Gretchen picked me up at the airport, and by sunset we were with Hugh and my entire family at the house on Emerald Isle. I like having a place that theoretically belongs to everyone, but technically belongs to me. It's neutral ground, but not quite, meaning that if someone hangs a picture I don't care for, I get to take it down, saying, "Let's rethink this." I, on the other hand, can hang whatever I like. Why would anyone frame a piece of plywood? My father asked the night before Thanksgiving. He was frowning at the artwork Janet had given me during my visit to Omaha. It's a one-eyed raccoon looking in a mirror, I told him. He took his glasses off and rubbed his eyes. Like hell it is. This Thanksgiving, my brother-in-law Bob was deep-frying the turkey. It has to be done outdoors, so while he scoped out a spot and constructed a wind barrier, I took my frozen tumor and headed to the canal with Lisa and my niece, who was 11 years old at the time and very shy. It was cold, and during the 15-minute walk, I asked Madeline who the most popular girl at her school was. She answered with no hesitation. And is she nice? I asked. She wasn't last year or the year before, but she is now. You will never forget the name of the most popular girl in the 6th grade, I said. Even when you're old and on your deathbed, it will come to you. That is her triumph. My most popular girl was Jane Teague, Lisa told us. That's such a good name, I said. Lisa nodded, and you had to call her Jane, even the teachers. She wouldn't answer to anything less. We arrived at the canal to find 3 boys standing on the footbridge and looking down into the water, their bikes sprawled like bodies on the ground around them. I leaned over the rail, but instead of the snapping turtles I was expecting, I saw only sliders, which are significantly smaller and less awe-inspiring. "You looking for Granddaddy?" the boy beside me asked. I said, "Granddaddy?" "People call him Godzilla sometimes, too," the kid told me. "He's the one with the messed up head. Me and my brother feed him toast a lot." "And grapes," the boy next to him said. "We give him them and crackers if we got them." I felt betrayed, the way you do when you discover that your cat has a secret secondary life and is being fed by neighbors who call him something stupid like Calypso. Worse is that he loves them as much as he loves you, which is to say, not at all, really. The entire relationship has been your own invention. "I never knew that turtle had a name," I said. The kid shrugged. "Sure does." "So where is he now?"
"Hibernating," the boy told me. "Like every year."
I was crestfallen.
"And when will he wake up?"
The kid reached down and picked up his bike.
"Springtime, unless he dies in his sleep. What, did you bring some bread for him?"
"Me?" I said. "No." Ashamed to admit it was something more intimate. "And after everything I went through," I whined on our way back to the house, "your lipoma will keep," Lisa assured me. "We'll just put it back in the freezer and you can feed it to Godzilla or Granddaddy or whatever his name is when you return in May. And what if there's a storm between now and the spring and the electricity goes out?" Lisa thought for a moment. "Something that's going to eat a tumor probably won't distinguish between a good one and a bad one." I won't say the hibernating turtle ruined my Thanksgiving. He did make it feel rather anticlimactic, though I'm not sure why. If you were to throw a lipoma to a dog, he'd swallow it in a single bite, then get that very particular look on his face that translates to, "Fuck, was that a tumor?" There'd be something to see. Turtles, on the other hand, never change expression and live with fewer regrets. I'm certain that when I return in May and drop my little gift into the canal, the snapper will eat it unthinkingly, the way he's eaten all the chicken hearts and fish heads I've thrown to him over the past year. Then he'll look around for more before disappearing, like the ingrate that he is, back into his foul and riled depths. A Modest Proposal. London is 5 hours ahead of Washington, D.C., except when it comes to gay marriage. In that case, it's 2 years and 5 hours ahead, which was news to me. "Really?" I said, on meeting 2 lesbian wives from Wolverhampton. "You can do that here?" "Well, of course they can," Hugh said, when I told him about it. Where have you been? Hugh can tell you everything about the current political situation in the UK. He knows who the Chancellor of the Exchequer is and was all caught up in the latest election for the, whatever you call it, that king-type person who's like the president but isn't. Prime Minister, he said. Jesus, you've been here how long? It was the same when we lived in Paris. Hugh regularly read the French papers. He listened to political shows on the radio, while I was like, is he the same emperor we had last year? When it comes to American politics, our roles are reversed.